Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. If you are willing to look for love through an online dating service, there are plenty of choices out there. We've talked about them before. Match, eHarmony, OkCupid, the list goes on and on. You upload some photos, fill out the questionnaire, and you're ready to start e-flirting with your cyber matches. But how do you choose which site to join? One smartphone app called Tinder focuses on making casual matchmaking easy, and they are not relying on word of mouth alone to get users. Joining us now to discuss Tinder and their marketing strategies, Bianca Bosker. She's executive tech editor at the Huffington Post. Welcome back, Bianca.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
First off, what is Tinder? How does it work? How does it distinguish itself from the other sites?
So if anyone out there has ever tried hotornot.com, this is going to be pretty familiar to them. But basically the idea is you've got an app, you download it on your phone, you open it up, and you basically just see photos one at a time of men or women nearby. And it's incredibly simple, which I think is part of the appeal. It's a photo, maybe some mutual friends, could use Facebook to log in, any mutual interests, and that's about it. I mean, there's a very brief profile section. It's really just photo-based, and then you can either hit a X or a like to get to the next person. You have to click one of those things, and if two people like each other, only then can they message each other. So you're never going to, you know, hear from people that you haven't also found attractive or appealing in some way. And people also won't know if you haven't liked them back.
Can it get any shallower?
It's a good question. It's a fair criticism, and I think people have, you know, they point out the fact that basically, you know, you're judging someone based on their looks alone. Of course, there's a little bit of information about maybe what they like, again, if they have friends in common with you. But by and large, it's just a photo and a couple of other pictures of them.
And to be fair,
I think that's part of the appeal, though. I think for people, you know, Tinder has turned passing judgment into a pastime. I mean, that's a lot of what people do online is they judge each other very, very quickly and move on to the next photo.
It's just, yeah, exactly. And really, isn't that what people do anyways most of the time?
Right. Well, I think the interesting thing about Tinder is that I think a lot of the early users of it have been people that wouldn't normally use online dating sites. But what they found in Tinder is, first of all, there's a gaming element to it. They make it seem like you're it can be a kind of fun thing to do, and it's not always about actually meeting or communicating with the person mm-hmm. that you like. Maybe it's about an ego boost. Maybe it's just about knowing someone else that you find attractive finds you attractive back. And the other piece of it is it takes 2 seconds to sign up for. If anyone out there has ever tried online dating, they know, you know, you have to answer a lot of questions. You have to pick out the right photos. You have to think about, you know, what's the cleverest way of describing the fact that you like to cook or long walks on the beach. And Tinder is just, it's a couple photos and bam, you're in, you're liking people, you're Xing people, and you're messaging if that's your thing.
So Tinder has anybody can use it, but their niche market is college students, which seems pretty apt to me. No pun intended.
Yeah. Well, so yeah, people between 18 and 24 are now 68% of all of their users. And the company doesn't actually release how many total users it has. But they really strategically from the beginning said, we're going to go after college students. We're going to kind of launch this on college campuses. We're going to recruit a small group of people to help seed it among their peers. And it's a smart move. It's surprising in some ways, I think, because actually, if you think about it, college students have a lot of different opportunities to meet each other, right? Mm-hmm. They're socializing, they're going to parties, they have frats. But the founders really thought, well, look, if we can get this demographic interested, then we have a good sense that other people will like it too. And if you have to remember that, you know, these kind of 20-something demographics and teens as well are seen as early adopters. And, you know, Facebook, for example, got its start on college campuses, right. And that helped bring along younger siblings, older peers that may have graduated recently, and eventually, of course, parents.
What do we mean by nearby when you do stuff like this? How nearby are we talking about? In the city? Could it be in the zip code? How does that work?
Yeah, so basically you narrow it to kind of a mile, 5 miles, 10 miles. You can choose, though, if you're open to kind of anyone within a, I think, 50 or 100-mile radius, you can get those people. But you can also, they just updated the app to let you narrow it down as well. And you pick your gender. I believe they've recently updated it so you can choose your age. So you can say, I want people in this particular age range. But, you know, it has that element of, I think some people have absolutely used it to meet up with people the very same day, right? They start messaging, they find something in common, whether it's a desire to, you know, get drinks or be whatever, mm-hmm. or go take it further than that, mm-hmm. and they can do that very easily because, of course, they're nearby.
What's really interesting about this is how they're marketing it. I mean, they actually mm-hmm. are enlisting kids who are in school, student representatives, to pass this around.
Right. So they're getting college students to basically use their offline social network to plug this online social network. So the story that I wrote recently was looking at one person of several that they've tapped around the country, a kid at Tufts University. And so he's what they call a campus rep pretender. He's unpaid, and he's actually going to be an intern with them later this summer. And what he's done is just sort of try and get influential social people on campus to try out the app. One of the ways they do that is by throwing these Tinder-themed parties. So, for example, I think they have one over Valentine's Day, and you have to download the Tinder app and show that you downloaded it in order to get into the party. Or in other cases, you know, it would be Tinder-themed, which meant you have to bring a date that you met on Tinder. Or in one case, he actually met a girl at another sorority nearby, and then they teamed up to throw a Tinder party at her school. According to him, it's very, very popular at Harvard, actually, where, you know, I think, I don't know if you've heard this old story that Harvard men would sort of bring in girls from other nearby all-girls schools. Mm-hmm. And apparently they're now using Tinder instead of buses to do that. So that the Harvard men will invite girls to their formals and parties over Tinder.
Okay. Why are the what is the benefit of doing this for no money? There's got to be something in it for them.
Yeah, well, I think that's a good question. The other interesting point is, you know, Tinder made a point of noting that they haven't paid for the parties that these campus reps have thrown. So, which is interesting. And apparently some of these are actually happening organically as well. It's becoming, you know, they have everything. Colleges, of course, are incredibly creative about how they theme whatever, you know, drink they want to do or, you know, big party. And Tinder has sort of lent itself, even outside of these campus rep programs, to a whole roster of themes for parties. But basically, I think, you know, this isn't unique only to Tinder, of course. You know, other startups and other major companies have long tried to kind of do these, you know, in-your-face marketing where they tap people on campus who are college students and ask them to basically tell their friends about it.
But
it seems
to do
more
it
organic.
For free?
Well, to do it occasionally, I think that's a great point. I mean, companies are getting a lot of benefit out of this, right? What you hear them saying is, look, you know, they're getting experience, they're resume fodder. But I have to raise the same question as you. You know, we're doing it for free, really? Are they getting enough out of it to do it for free? And especially if, you know, they're not. I mean, is a free T-shirt really enough? Which is what Tinder provides in some cases. But yeah, like their excuse is just, you know, this is resume building. We might identify talent that we could hire later on, so on and so forth. But I think that companies are probably coming up ahead.
And so these parties, they're happening. You based it on the story of the Tufts University fellow, but this is happening all over the place.
Yeah, so actually Tinder's initial launch came at a party at USC. So one of the founders, his brother was a student at USC, and he had a big birthday party. And so one way to sort of initially get the word out among college students, the founders basically threw this guy a birthday party, asked him to invite all of his friends who were college students at the time at USC, and that apparently helped downloads skyrocket from around 400 at the beginning of the week to 4,000 a week later following the party. This isn't, again, unique to Tufts. I've heard of it happening at other schools around the East Coast, again, where maybe there's not a Tinder campus rep, but Tinder has such sort of appeal and virality that college students are throwing these Tinder-themed parties.
So what about other competitors to Tinder? Are they doing similar things? Is there anything out there? You said you mentioned one early on.
Yeah, so Uber apparently also has a rep on Tufts University. Brand consultants that I spoke with said that there's really been an uptick in the last 12 to 18 months of startups that are really trying to not just rely on their web savvy and word of mouth, but really make a more strategic effort to plug themselves into college campuses. And let's remember why this demographic is so important, right? It's they're a group of people incredibly active on smartphones. They are active social networking users. They're always looking for a new thing to try. And again, I think their peers, their parents, people older and younger than them, do look to this demographic as one that sets trends and is aware and always kind of finding the next hot, cool new thing. So they are going out of their way to try and make sure that their brands get seen and adopted by that particular group of users. But, you know, it's interesting because we've seen it from big companies for a long time, companies like Microsoft and HP and Target. And it's funny because, I think Facebook, again, very successful early on college, but, it seemed more word of mouth than it was these strategic campus reps.
It makes me wonder about the Match and the eHarmony and the OkCupid mm-hmm. and so forth, what they're doing to morph into something that's going to be appealing to, college students, but more importantly, post-college, because it's a different generation coming out.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. It raises the question, is Tinder going to be the kind of gateway drug to online dating sites?
Yeah, right.
So one of Tinder's early investors was actually IAC, which is a company that owns, I believe, OkCupid and Match.com.
Okay.
So once they get a taste for online dating, Tinder is, again, something much more casual, very quick. Are they going to step it up a notch and try and do something a little more serious, in which case that might be helpful for IAC? But I think, again, it's important to remember, I've spoken with a number of college students that do use Tinder, and they talk about it as, it's useful to make friends, it's useful to find dates. But again, there's this real appeal of the ego boost.
Hmm.
You are using the app to find out other people that you find attractive that also find you attractive. On other online dating sites, you might sign up, especially if you're female, and you can get a ton of messages from people that you don't know, maybe you don't want to hear from. Whereas Tinder, it's really, there's the cute guy I saw in seminar. He thinks I'm cute too. I mean, whether or not you do anything about that, it's not the worst feeling in the world. So people talk about using it really for just kind of a confidence booster. And again, I think that's very different from other online dating apps where it can feel a little spammier,
right.
Like you're getting messages from a ton of strangers you don't know.
Yeah, I've leaned over a couple shoulders watching people go through those before. So,
you've never tried it yourself?
Well, I've been married. I've been married 20 years, and with I can only watch from afar.
Yeah. and Facebook just introduced graph search. I mean, yesterday they rolled out graph search, and a lot of people, that could easily be used as a dating app. I mean, people have, of course, used Facebook to break the ice for years now, but, with graph search, if you type in, let's say, friends of mine who are single who live in New York City, there you go. I mean, you've got a whole list of people that you can just start to email and ask out on dates.
But I won't because I'm married. But Bianca.
Well, your listeners out there that might be
exactly,
single.
Exactly. Bianca, thank you so much for joining us today. I enjoyed it. It's always, great to get insight into this. So thanks a lot.
Give it a try. Find someone that you can have download and give it a whirl.
I'm looking at her right now. So, all right. Bianca Bakker. She's executive tech editor at Huffington Post. Thanks again. And coming up, we're going to talk about philanthropy, another online pursuit for many people. Philanthropy. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Support for 89.7 comes from the State Auto Insurance Companies, providing home, automobile, and business insurance products and services to Central Ohioans since 1921. State Auto is on the web at stateauto.com.
The WOSU Public Media Member Card Benefit of the Month for July is the Columbus Children's Theater. Enjoy two-for-one admission to the galleries all month long. Support 89.7 NPR News at the $85 level and receive your member card. Just visit WOSU.org. And thank you for supporting 89.7 NPR News.
Support comes from Assistive Technology of Ohio. AT Ohio is a green alternative for used computers. Donating computers makes a positive impact on the environment by keeping toxic e-waste out of landfills. Computers are refurbished and made available to Ohioans with disabilities. Donation information at atohio.org.
Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. When tragedy strikes and the call goes out for help, many dig deep for those in need. But we're not always sure that our heartfelt donations are getting to the heart of the problem. And maybe you don't want to wait until there's a catastrophe and wonder where in the world someone could use the help you can offer. Joining us now to talk about the philosophy of giving and how the internet could help the world's most needy is Steve Brown. He's executive director of the Maximin Project. Welcome to the show, Stephen.
Hi, thanks for having me in.
The project was created, it's the Maximin.
Yes, Maximin.
Maximin Project was created not only to connect potential donors with need, but also to educate them. How will Maximin differ from other online charity sites?
Yeah, good. So I think this is really the thing that's what we're trying to do a little bit differently. We're trying to create an end-to-end user experience for people who have a kind of vague impression that there's very extreme poverty in the world, and maybe they feel like they wish they could do something about it, but they don't really know where it is or really exactly what it's like. And there's this concern that that we don't really understand what could make a difference. So we want to create a single website that starts out by educating people, not through a lot of reading, but through interactive infographics. And also, to some extent, some video, and also, obviously, there will have to be some reading, but sort of lowering the bar to the education to try to make it easy to see where the most needy regions on the planet are within a few moments of looking at the site.
How do you know people care that much about what's happening around the world?
Mm-hmm. Well, so I think actually the example that you brought up a second ago of what happens when disaster strikes is a really great example, because it becomes this really newsworthy event that a lot of people pay attention to and they become very invested in for a very short period of time. And then it kind of fades into the background. And really what we're trying to do is take people from that kind of crisis giving to a more thoughtful engagement with the long-term realities of poverty. Because, I mean, these crises are important and a lot of people are affected. But
and they often hit the very poorest.
They do often hit the very poorest. But it's funny because, or not funny, it's tragic, I guess, because it isn't as though once that story stops being newsworthy, it actually goes away, right? I mean, there are more people dying every day for lack of basic necessities, lack of basic health care, lack of access to clean water and things like that than happen in these crises. It's just that it's this kind of background information that we don't really pay attention to. So we're trying to help people pay attention to that in a way that is as inviting and interesting and positive as possible, but also, at the same time, very thoughtful and very well-researched and backed up by that kind of hard data so that people can kind of relax into picking a project that just seems interesting to them with the knowledge that the only projects that we're recommending are ones that have been demonstrated to be addressing strategic needs.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's Tech Tuesday. My guest is Stephen Brown. He's executive director of the Maximin Project. If you have a question or comment for Stephen, give us a call, 614-292-8513. a project name that strikes the fear into this radio talk show host. You have a PhD in philosophy.
Yes.
And you've taught ethics courses. Tell us how your study of philosophy led to this project in the first place.
Good. So my actual dissertation research was fairly abstract stuff about how the goodness of people's character relates to the what makes actions right and wrong. So it's not directly related to what I'm doing here with Maximin. But as I was going through that graduate program at Ohio State, I was teaching a lot of applied ethics classes. We have a class there that's called Contemporary Social and Moral Issues in the United States. And I try, you know, we talk about things like abortion and the death penalty and things like that. But I always try to make sure that we cover in any class that I teach, really, wherever it's possible, this particular issue, the issue of extreme global poverty. Because I think it's different than those other issues, in a sense, because it's really an area where I think a lot of people from a lot of different perspectives can find some common ground. There are controversial aspects to it, but I think it's more in the question of what's actually effective than it is, should we do something about it if there was something effective? Because it seems obvious that if there is something effective to be done, then we should be doing something about it.
And so how did you get to the name Maximin? What does that mean?
Yeah, good. So this is from a philosopher named John Rawls. It also gets used in the economics world and in game theory. A Maximin strategy is one that doesn't try to raise the average or raise the total, but it tries to maximize the minimum. So the idea here is we're trying to cater to donors who care about addressing the most extreme forms of poverty. And we want to argue that that's actually the best way to try to give. Obviously, if you were standing and you saw two people in need and one person was about to die and the other person just had a slight scratch, you would want to help the person who is about to die. Same thing here. There is poverty all over the world, but it's poverty of different types. And the type of poverty that exists in, say, sub-Saharan Africa or Southeast Asia just doesn't really exist here in the United States. Even very low-income United States households, if you make about $15,000 a year in the United States, you're considered to be very poor. But globally speaking, even if you adjust for purchasing power and differences in the value of the dollar, even if you do that, that kind of money globally is actually quite wealthy. And I think that most people who live in the developed world don't really understand that difference, or at least many people in the developed world don't really understand that difference. And so we're trying to call attention to those most extreme forms of poverty and say, look, let's try to do whatever is effective in maximizing those minimums.
The homepage of your site is built around a color-coded map that's based on the Human Development Index. How does that help the donor? Tell us about that index and what that means.
Good. So the Human Development Index is put out by the UN every year, and it's an attempt to combine a lot of data that's being gathered about poverty all over the world into a very simple metric that tracks a lot of other things. So it's built around life expectancy, average yearly income, and the number of years of education that people get. So places like the UN and the World Bank are tracking tons and tons and tons of different metrics, like the amount of years of education that women tend to get and the number of acres of farmable land and all sorts of great stuff. But research has shown that those three metrics, life expectancy, average yearly income, and number of years of education, track a lot of other things. So it's a nice, reliable, although still somewhat crude way of trying to get a big picture of what's happening in a particular region. So we're using that as our base level visualization. So you can get an idea of a broad perspective of poverty on a region by region basis. But then we also allow you to drill down more specifically to other metrics. So in the prototype site that we have right now, you can look at those three, the life expectancy and the yearly income and the number of years of education. But as we develop further, it's pretty simple actually to pull that information out of those databases and then recolor maps and other kinds of infographics according to that. So you can switch your metrics if you're interested in something else.
What how do you decide, how are you going to decide what charities will be on the site? How often will they change? How will that work?
So we're being pretty cautious about what we're saying here right now, because we understand that this is really going to be the crux of what we're doing. Right now, we're partnering with a lot of different organizations and really trying to listen to what they think is the best way to do this. So we're talking to some of the world's top charities and a lot of the really great charity evaluators that are out there, and really trying to listen to them about what's the best way to do this. In a nutshell, what we're going to do is build a system where organizations that are doing aid work in these areas can come and create profiles and submit information about themselves. We'll do whatever's necessary to demonstrate that those are real organizations and not people just putting money in their pockets. And that'll be easier, obviously, if you have a U.S. counterpart than if you don't. But we actually do want to try to solve that problem even for smaller organizations that don't have a U.S. counterpart, because those organizations are often the ones with the most local buy-in. They really understand the situation on the ground, and they're actually tends to be the most efficient. But it's hard then to figure out which ones are real and which ones aren't. So there's going to be a range of challenges there to identify that. But once we can identify that this is a legitimate organization, then that organization has the capacity to submit programs to our projects to our system and then raise funds. However, so it's kind of an anybody can play. Any organization that's a real organization can put a project in. But we're not going to recommend projects unless they can do some work to demonstrate that it's a project worth funding. And there are a number of ways that might be done. So we are going to build a system that allows you to accumulate, for lack of a better word, something like merit badges, right? So you can say, look, we've got a really good Charity Navigator rating, or we've got a recommendation from someplace like GiveWell, or we have very fine-grained, detailed reports on what we do on a day-to-day basis or on a month-to-month basis, right? So anything that might count as a virtue for an aid organization, you can kind of demonstrate that you do that. And the projects that do that best will float to the top.
I think the tracking issue is important to a lot of people. And I think that's why organizations like Save the Children, remember those on television? Mm-hmm. I really don't see them much anymore. Mm-hmm. But they'd say, send your monthly, gift now, whatever the level might have been, and we'll send you a picture of that child that you're saving.
Yeah.
What is there a component of that in this?
Yeah, absolutely. So this side website that I'm talking about, where the organizations have their interface to submit information, we're going to make it as easy as we can, even with bad internet connections in the middle of sub-Saharan Africa, to provide updates about the projects that you're doing. And then we're building a almost like an investment portfolio for donors, so that when they give to a project, they can be updated as often as they want to about what's happening in that region. And they can also see over time how the impact that they're creating is accumulating. So you can see, you've distributed this many mosquito nets, which is likely to have saved this many lives, and you've educated this many children, which is likely to have created this many jobs, or whatever it is, right? And we will do that both in that sort of high abstraction level, but also at the more specific level. I mean, anytime we can get information from the people running the projects on the ground about the actual person who got that mosquito net or the actual child that was educated, we want to make it easy to feed that information back to the people who are funding it.
Is Maximin, are you shooting for young new donors, or will experienced philanthropists appreciate its value as well? Who do you see as your target market?
That's a really good question. It's one I get asked a lot. We are definitely targeting we're targeting everybody, right? I know that's not what you're supposed to say in situations like this. So what we're actually doing is we're focusing on what we might call the average Facebook user, someone who spends a fair amount of time on the internet, who is fairly web savvy, and who has, either has or is likely to have in the near future a certain amount of expendable income that they could use to fund projects like these. Now, I just think that the kind of people who can engage with this kind of data visualization is actually a pretty broad group of people. And with the testing that we've done so far, I mean, I use it when I teach ethics classes. When I'm teaching about poverty, I'll actually bring up that infographic you were talking about, the color-coded map, and I'll show people. And it has a very dramatic effect on the students because they don't really understand just how extreme the differences in wealth across the world are. But it makes it very easy for them to see. But at the same time, people like my mom and older donors are also able to engage with it. So I mean, it is true that we kind of have a youth focus because we're focusing on, very dynamic, interactive, light-hearted in so much as possible, but still thoughtful ways of presenting this data. But I think that's actually going to be attractive to a lot of people.
Indiegogo, one of the things about that and, you know, any kind of crowdsourcing is you can give a little mm-hmm. and you feel like you're contributing something mm-hmm. at least.
Yeah.
You don't have to be a big giver. You could give $5, you could give $10 or whatever, or, mm-hmm. you know, you get the more you give, the more you get kind of. What about this? Is this going to be tapping people for a little bit because that's all they can afford, or are you not going to really feel comfortable there because you don't have much?
Yeah. So I'm glad you brought up Indiegogo because we're actually doing a fundraising campaign over there right now. So
that's
check
how
it out.
You're raising your money to start that launch.
That's right. But ultimately, the system we're building is a crowdfunding platform. Right? It's a way for people to contribute whatever they have available to them, small or large, to projects and work together with others to actually get them funded and then get that kind of information about what they've been able to accomplish. One of the great things about engaging extreme poverty is that you can actually produce a substantial amount of impact with even small amounts of money. So like a mosquito net costs about $3 or $4 to manufacture and distribute. And that's very likely to radically transform the individual people's lives that have access to that kind of way of battling malaria, which has been shown to be a very effective way of battling malaria. So I do think that this is we've built it for that audience that may only have a little bit to give, but we are also looking into ways that we might partner with. There's a lot of funds out there who work with larger donors to try to help them find worthy projects, and that may be another community that we can serve in helping to vet these different organizations and recommend them.
I mean, in political campaigns, it's a point of pride that you've collected lots of small campaign donations
yeah.
from lots of people.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if charities think in the same way.
Yeah. Well, so we definitely think that way because we recognize that although it is definitely true that you can create a substantial amount of impact with even a small amount of money. Giving money to even the most effective projects is not the only thing to be done. Obviously, there's different kinds of political engagement. There's the way that we spend our money and the way that we think about the things that we buy and where they're manufactured. And all of those things play into this as well. So our strategy is really not just to get people to give, but to become invested in what's going on globally and to teach them as much as we can about about what poverty looks like and about how their life plays into that larger picture. There, I think it is really valuable to just get the largest audience you can because really what we're trying to do is not just mobilize donors, but transform the way that people are thinking about the world.
Well, Stephen Brown, thanks for joining us today to tell us about it.
Thank you.
Stephen Brown, he's executive director of the MaxiMin Project. For more information on that, I'm sure there's a link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides, or there will be very, very soon. So coming up, we'll wrap up Tech Tuesday this week with our usual Russell Holly and the latest on the 3D printer. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Support comes from the Physicians Free Clinic and Voluntary Care Network, providing charity medical care for Central Ohio's uninsured patients. More about joining the Columbus Medical Association Foundation in supporting the clinic is at goodhealthcolumbus.org.
On the next Fresh Air, journalist Alfredo Corchado, who spent years covering the violence of drug cartels in Mexico. Once at a restaurant in Laredo, Texas, two young men came in with a warning.
One of them takes his hand out and points at me and does like he was using a gun. Bam, bam, bam.
Corchado's new memoir is called Midnight in Mexico. Join us.
Today at noon on 89.7 NPR News.
Support comes from Lancaster Festival, taking place July 18th through the 27th in Lancaster, Ohio, including performances by Michael Bolton, Bruce Springsteen tribute band Bruce in the USA, Ohio's American Idol, Crystal Bowersox, and Bruce Robinson and Kelly Willis. Details and tickets at lancasterfestival.org.
Sustaining givers are the future of 89.7 NPR News. A sustainer gives a fixed amount each month. For example, $5, $10, or even $20 per month can be charged to your credit card, and then your membership is always active and your member card renews automatically. Visit wosu.org/sustainer and sign up today.
Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. If you own an iPhone or any kind of smartphone, you might wonder how you ever survived without one. With hundreds of thousands of games and other apps available to entertain and connect us, it's easy to take the technology for granted. Rewind just a bit, though, over 5 years. 5 years. 5 years ago, and everything was different. That's because it was before the birth of Apple's App Store. Apple will be celebrating its fifth birthday tomorrow. Joining us now to talk about that and more is Russell Holley, tech blogger for Geek.com. Hi, Russell.
Hey.
So, wow, the Apple App Store turns five. I mean, very few five-year-olds in the world have had such an impact, right?
Oh, absolutely. It's funny, you know, as I was going over this before I sent it to you, one of the things that came to mind was how, you know, you tease me every once in a while for this short span of time that I often have where I talk about things that are, you know, right around the corner as though they're months away,
right,
or years away. And this was a perfect highlight of that. You know, this is the App Store has made a huge, huge impact on how so many people, you know, do things on the internet and really do things with phones and tablets. And it's only 5 years old.
So how do you measure the impact of something like the Apple App Store in the fast-moving world of technology? You knew exactly what I was thinking, where every week we have something literally new to talk about.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is a perfect example of that. I mean, it's one of those things that it is impossible to, you know, pay attention to the you know, amount of apps that get released every single day.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, it's true that, you know, we have a quantity versus quality issue in a lot of these app stores now where, you know, we've got 900 versions of, you know, the same app that'll open a PDF so that you can read it. but, you know, through that, you know, we've also got some of these really amazing ideas that have come not just from, you know, a productivity perspective, you know, like being able to you know, place a marker on a map for when you've left your car in a parking lot or you know, something like that. But also, you know, when it comes to mobile games, you know, it really wasn't all that long ago that, you know, my first phone, you know, it had a black and white version of Snakes on it. And that was the thing that I did when I was standing in line somewhere. And now I've got, you know, really impressive 3D graphics that are better, you know, than, you know, game consoles that I had as a kid.
So how big is the Apple App Store now?
I don't think I have the official number that they had, that they announced at the Worldwide Developers Conference, but if memory serves, it grows at a rate of something like 1,500 apps a day or something like that.
Oh my gosh. And, you know, the one thing about Apple is they do vet to a certain extent, right?
They vet to a pretty significant extent. I mean, they don't allow any apps with adult content. You know, they try to keep it, you know, mostly offensive-free. And they have a system in place, you know, where if apps do kind of get past their their internal filters, you know, that they can be reported and dealt with. So, I mean, there's still a pretty significant process, you know, when someone submits an app before it gets to the App Store, and not just, you know, when an app is submitted, but also when updates are made for the apps as well.
Which makes that $1,500 a day amazing. So how is Apple going to celebrate? Is there a celebration, and do I get any cake?
I don't know that there's going to be cake involved, but every time Apple's had a big milestone like this, you know, the last was when they had, 25 million apps total in the App Store, which was about a year and a half ago. They do a big sale, where they had a ton of apps that were only 25 cents that were usually, $2 or $5. But it seems like what they're going to do with this, that they have a whole bunch of apps that are really, really popular apps that are usually, $5 and even as high as $10 that are actually free right now. And some of them are Map My Ride Plus, Knots 3D. These are all, just kind of productivity apps, but also games like Super Brothers, Sword and Sorcery, and Tiny Wings, which are all, really popular apps in the App Store right now, that are all starting now, and they haven't said when it's going to stop, but I would assume that it's probably the entire week would be free in the App Store right now.
Well, you can get a lot of free apps, but they have advertising all the way through them.
Yeah, this is as though you had purchased the app.
This is
the paid version of the app is what you're getting, not the ad supported version of the app.
I only do pretty much mostly free apps. Because I'm such a chintz. But I've learned how to get away from the ads as quickly as possible. I'm an expert at that. All right, so tell us about some of the best apps that will be made free. Do you know about any?
If you've got kids, and if your kids every once in a while take your phone to do stuff, Where's My Water is something that was done by Disney, I guess probably a year ago now, and is crazy popular. It's got this little alligator, and it's a ton of puzzle games where, you basically are leading the alligator to water so that he can take a shower. That's a really good one. Infinity Blade 2 is another game that is very graphically intensive. It's one of the flagship apps that Apple usually demonstrates new hardware on, just because it's very visually intensive and very pretty. Map My Ride Plus is something that I tell every single iPhone owner that they should have installed on their phone, just because it makes it so that you don't ever lose your car.
Okay, I will do that. I have lost my car.
How to Cook Everything is a pretty popular cooking app that I've actually not used myself. Barefoot World Atlas is a more of a photography app than anything else. It shows you some really beautiful photos of the world and stuff like that.
Yeah, we've heard about that before. Okay, well, cool. Just go to the Apple Store and it tells you where to go, right?
Yeah, well, you have to hunt for the apps individually. Apple doesn't have a list of them on the homepage yet. I suspect that they will probably tomorrow.
Okay.
Because that's the actual fifth anniversary is going to be on July 10th.
That's so. Okay. Happy birthday, Apple Apps. What would we do without you? All right. You did an experiment on a Rust-Oleum product. And I was wondering, why is this technological?
So this is a process that started, I guess the first time that I saw it was an MIT student was working on it about a year and a half ago, originally as a project to make it so that it was easier to get condiments out of bottles, so like ketchup out of ketchup bottles. It was easier to get it out there without there being any residue. And the coating that was created, it was a nano coating called super hydrophobic. And that very long word really just meant that if it was liquid, any kind of liquid, instead of sticking or smearing to whatever the surface was, it would beat up and roll away. And it's something that I've personally been fascinated with for a while, because it's something that, depending on how it is available, you can really put it on a ton of things and be able to, to benefit from not having standing water or, not having to worry about mud smearing on certain surfaces. And so Rust-Oleum is one of the first to make this kind of coating available in stores for $20 that you can get. It's a two-step process. You spray on this bottom layer and then you spray on this top layer. And pretty much as advertised, I sprayed it on tires and on my deck at home, and, you know, water and mud and even, you know, chocolate syrup, instead of sticking and smearing and getting gross, it beads up and rolls away.
And does it last forever?
No, it's, you know, the coating, it works essentially like a can of spray paint. So as long as the surface is intact and that material isn't rubbed away, then it'll work. I guess they don't have, you know, it varies per surface. And you know, obviously, if you put it on something like a deck, then there's foot traffic and things like that to keep in mind. But it looks like something that, you know, would be able to stick around most places for, you know, at least a month or two, you know, after receiving a coat.
Now, first of all, before we move on, I think super hydrophobic means an extreme fear of water. Just so you know. But for the purposes of our conversation, Alex.
Sounds correct. But you're essentially bestowing a fear of water on an inanimate object. So it takes
true.
A slightly different.
True. All right. So what kind of materials can you use this on? What would you spray it on? A light switch? I mean, electronics? What do you use it on sure, the deck and everything, but who wants to spray the deck every few months? You know, let's be realistic, but it's expensive too.
So the big thing, yeah, it definitely would be. The big thing that Rust-Oleum says is, you know, it's designed for surfaces that are metallic or rubber or wooden, things like that. There were tests done by the company, by Rust-Oleum. They had a video where they very carefully applied this to a phone, you know, both inside and out, to a smartphone, and then were able to submerge it in water without there being any damage or anything like that. And that is an exciting proposition, but you have to be extremely careful with that, and it only works until it doesn't, and when it doesn't, you're in trouble. So it's hard to say that would be totally useful to the average consumer. There was also in the demonstration where it got sprayed on, you know, a shirt or something like that. But on that same line, you know, you could, you know, if you had a flag that you had outside, you could apply it to that and you know, the same, keep it safe. Shoes are something that I've seen a couple people apply them to, you know, kind of add an extra layer on waterproof shoes and things like that.
Okay. And what about the chemicals used in the product? Is it safe on surfaces? Is this a nanotechnology? What is it that made it? And is it really good for children and pets?
So what I have found, and I haven't done enough research to say for sure about how safe it is for children and pets yet. But what I found with the material that you're spraying on, specifically with this Rust-Oleum stuff, it gives it kind of a frosted white look. And when you first apply it, some of that material comes off pretty easily if you touch it. So if it's in an area where, you know, there's going to be a lot of hand traffic, you're going to have some of this material on your fingers just by running your hand over the surface. So that's probably not great. You know, it's probably something that, you know, you wouldn't put on things like handrails or light switches or things like that because, you know, there's a lot of hand traffic there.
Okay.
But it's, there was nothing, you know, it obviously follows a lot of the same properties that you get from anything that comes in a spray paint can, which is, you know, don't try and eat this. So I don't know for sure, you know, what, you know, how toxic it is or anything like that, but I would not personally apply it somewhere where I knew that, you know, my kids or my cat were gonna, you know, lick it or something like that.
Yeah, I'm trying to think where would I put it, maybe on pillows outdoor kind of upholstery, that kind of thing.
Yeah, that would work. I mean, you know, really it's something a couple of friends of mine who ride bikes were really excited about putting it on their tires and then going you know, like mountain biking or something like that. Because there is no, you know, mud doesn't stick to the tires and it all just, it just falls right off. It's really impressive.
Well, yeah, I get that. But I'm also wondering what it does to the traction of the tires then.
No, it didn't do anything to the traction of the tires.
Wow.
Because the treads are still, you know, the treads are still there and the treads are what do all the hard work there.
Okay. All right. Well, good. I mean, check it out. 3D, but I want to get to we're running out of time. I want to get to the 3D printed duck
foot. You want to get to the most
fun stuff,
story.
And I highly recommend. I hope that we will post a link to the video of what's the name of the duck?
Buttercup.
Buttercup, the duck who was born without a foot, right?
Well, the foot was the left foot on this duck was backwards when he was.
That's there. Right, backwards. Wow, that's weird.
Yeah.
That's another story, I'm sure. But so, anyways, it didn't work. They had to amputate it. Then the owner figured out something to do with 3D printing. Tell us about
it. Yeah. Reached out to a company called Novacopy to try and experiment with a 3D printed solution. Now, we've talked a lot about 3D printed stuff in the past, and it's really not, this is rigid, hard stuff, not even close to being the same kind of material that a duck's foot is made of. So it would be really difficult to make, you know, kind of a plastic or ABS, you know, foot. But what they did instead was cast the remaining foot, 3D print a mold, and then, you know, make a gelatin mold of the duck's foot and then, you know, attach it. And apparently it works really well.
Yeah, if you watch the video, it's obvious it works really well. It was so cute. So they used that camera to take a picture all the way around of another duck foot, a sister of Buttercup. The foot of a sister of Buttercup, I guess.
Right. Mm-hmm.
There's a special camera you use, right?
Yeah, three-dimensional camera, you know, just capturing the 3D images and trying to get, you know, as accurate a representation so that when they printed that mold, they could make it, you know, as accurate as possible.
And they created a mold in which they then poured in the more malleable rubber type of material, right?
That's right. Yeah, they poured this material in, and this was a series, a pretty significant series of trial and error. They didn't say exactly how many times they had to repeat the process, but they did say that, you know, it was something that required quite a bit of trial and error until they got something that was, you know, the right shape and didn't have things that Buttercup would attack in attempt to try and move it. So they had to make sure that it was colored correctly, and it took, you know, a lot of kind of trial and error until they got something that was the right consistency and close enough to, you know, the right tensile strength so that the duck could actually walk on it.
Pretty amazing. I mean, that changed a duck's life.
It absolutely did. And that was one of the cool things about the mold process being 3D printed was that they could recreate, they could make adjustments to the mold on the fly. They could make new molds really quickly. And it was one of those things that, you know, could certainly have been done other ways, but was able to be done much faster because of the 3D printing technology.
Yeah, it's the color, you said the color was key in this?
Yeah, so this was something from an early report when they were first trying this. You know, what I shared with you was the kind of the finished product, but one of the early attempts where they had just kind of a white material that they were trying. Buttercup actually attacked it because it, you know, it was the wrong color. It didn't seem like it belonged.
And when Buttercup had it's kind of a reddish or an orangish red version put on, the final version, or at least the current version, just stood there for a while. And then they said, come on, Buttercup.
Yeah.
They bribed him with something and he just started to walk.
Yeah, it was. It obviously was something that, you know, it didn't seem like it required a lot of getting used to in the video. It really seemed like they attached it, and pretty shortly after he figured it out.
Well, that's a very happy 3D printer story, Russell Holly. Thanks for sharing that with us, and thanks for joining us again this week.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
That's Russell Holly, tech blogger for Geek.com. Thanks for listening today. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus and streaming on the web at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.